I look out the window on a late January day and see blossoms on my apricot trees. What to call this new season? In the confused heat, the buds turn into white flowers, pink-eyed. The fruit sets 3 weeks ahead of its usual clock and heavy, and I can't help thinking it's going to be one of those bumper crop years. I'll be eating apricots off the tree all June and still have plenty of leftover fruit to make sun jam in July. But I know a lot can go wrong between now and summer. My father and his father were farmers who couldn't hold on to the farm. They got rid of our last orchard a couple years before I was born. There were two versions of the story, one my grandfather told and one my grandmother swore was truer. That ranch beside the San Joaquin River, its entrance limned in pomegranates, became a faraway picture to me. In the city where we grew up, not 10 miles removed from the farm belt, we stayed dumb to our place. What kid in the Fresno suburbs knew we had built the grandest reclamation project in the world, and all it took was transporting water from where it was abundant to where it was scarce? Canals and ditches filled with snowmelt in spring, and they ran like veins through our subdivisions, but we never thought to ask, and our elders never thought to tell us where the flow was going and to whom and by what rights. The summer before turning 17, I went to work at a packing house in Selma, the raisin capital of the world, and got to know a man named Amos Margosian, who farmed stone fruit to the east out of Yedem, which means Eden in Armenian. Margosian was just about the darkest Caucasian I had ever seen. He sported a white felt cowboy hat and was famous for picking his plums a little green to catch the early market's big money. He would come in immaculate from the fields and stand on the call line and watch the sorter reject his fruit right and left. Too early, too green, too early, too green. He would grow madder by the minute and storm up to the second floor office where he would cuss out the packing house boss, who was an even darker-skinned Armenian than he was. And then he'd return the next day with his plums a little less green. By the end of summer, I figured out that the farmer who wasn't a fool didn't count his fruit in the box until it was in the box. I wait until mid-March and let the nubs grow into something capable before I even say the word fruit or guess how many mason jars I'll need to handle the load on my 3 apricot trees. So many babies suck on each little branch that I have a choice to make. To make big fruit, you take your thumb and index finger and pinch off 2 of every 3 offspring. There are no runts in the litter to make the job less cruel. The kill is purely arbitrary. Man, not nature, selects what lives and dies. Thinning fruit is routine on the farm. Absent the drain of siblings, the chosen ones have a chance to size up and sell for a premium to the wholesale houses. Thinning fruit makes less sense in the backyard. Here, I'm compelled by a different greed. Each Blenheim apricot and Alberta peach and Santa Rosa plum and Mission fig and Page mandarin and Washington navel and Thompson seedless grape that fights its way to suburban ripe is a thing to behold. And so I put off thinning. Then one April morning, nothing particularly eventful about the night before, I walk outside and I'm confronted by a lineup of trees that suddenly appear weightless. As I draw closer, I can see hundreds of apricots, firm and green, sitting in a pile at trunk's feet. I survey each branch, sure I have missed something, but not a single fruit has held. Only a trespass of some persistence can explain such a mass shedding. And I begin to curse the squirrel, the rat, the opossum, the jaybird, the 16-year-old son. Then I think better. They would be after sugar, and sugar is 2 months away.